from WYPR in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall, and this is Choral Arts Classics. Tonight on Choral Arts Classics, a conversation with Maren Alsop, the music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, about two masterpieces, John Adams' haunting elegy to the victims of 9/11 on the transmigration of souls, and Beethoven's towering Ninth Symphony. Baltimore Choral Arts Society will team up with the BSO for four performances of these great pieces in early June, and tonight, Maren Alsop gives us a preview. We'll also talk with two composers who have formed a chorus to perform music by local composers. Douglas Buchanan and Joshua Bornfield, both singing members of Choral Arts, are also gifted composers, whose new group, Canticum Novum, will present their music and the music of other composers in the area. Hello again, and thanks for joining us for Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and the co-host of Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on 88.1 WYPR. Glad you could be with us tonight, as we have done for the past 11 years. On the last Tuesday night of the month, from September through April, we get together and we listen to and talk about great choral and vocal music, and we sample recordings and live performances of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and special guests. As always, I appreciate your tuning in and joining us tonight. And I'm also delighted that Maren Alsop is joining us. She was appointed music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra in 2007. In 2012, she became the chief conductor of the Sao Paulo Symphony Orchestra in Brazil. She's also been the music director of the Cabrillo Festival of Contemporary Music in California for more than 20 years. And of course, she conducts major orchestras all over the world. Maren, it's good to see you.
Great to be here, Tom.
So let's talk a little bit about the Transmigration of Souls of John Adams. Very, very powerful pieces, a piece, rather. Start by telling us the forces that John has assembled and the elements that are a part of this thing.
Well, it's a fascinating piece. Of course, he uses, as we know, a big chorus, a children's chorus. The orchestra is quite large as well. And so those are the main forces. And he uses these texts that are excerpted from a variety of sources, things that people posted. If you remember back to 9/11, when people would go down and post something about their missing relative, or maybe some of the messages that were left on voicemail. The texts are extremely, you know, in some ways they're very, very simple, but because of their simplicity and sincerity, they're extraordinarily poignant.
He also uses a sort of sound design, a pre-recorded electronic tape that has sounds of the city, you know, cars going
right
by, beeping horns and that kind of stuff, and some very poignant voices that we hear on this pre-recorded tape.
Yeah, and it's like a soundscape in a way. You know, when you're in a city and you have those background noises going on, and then suddenly something jumps out at you, and then it recedes to the background. It's very cool.
What do you think John's particular appeal is? I mean, I think he's the leading contemporary American composer on the scene today. His music is played all over the world. What do you think it is about John's music that that resonates so powerfully?
John's music, it's always going somewhere. There's always, I guess I would liken it to a story that always has a moral. There's a moral to the story. So you come away with a perspective and a point of view, and you've been on some kind of emotional journey with John's music. And I would say that for every single piece of his I've done, and I've close to conducted everything he's written.
Yeah, and he often sort of rips from the headlines the subject matter of what he writes about. He wrote an opera about Nixon's visit to China in the 70s. He wrote an opera about Klinghoffer and that affair and the boat where a man was thrown overboard. Is there anything in particular about this 9/11 piece, this Transmigration of Souls, that is at all distinguished from the other stuff that he's written?
Well, I think it's appropriate to the tragedy itself, because the tragedy was so massive that I think it's easy to lose one's relationship to it. I think what John has done so beautifully is he's personalized it through the voices of these individuals. And, you know, when you hear a story about, a woman unable to erase the last voicemail message from, you know, her son or her loved person, I mean, that really hits home then. It personalizes it. And I think he's able to do that. He's able to capture the large-scale trauma of the event and yet make it extremely personal and enable us to relate to it as individuals.
What was your own personal experience of 9/11? You're a New Yorker, born and bred. Where were you on 9/11? Were you in the country or were you?
I was living in Denver, Colorado, actually. I was running on the treadmill and I put the news on and I couldn't understand what was going on. And so I actually was, I was the one to call many of my friends in Manhattan and tell them, you know, to turn on the television, something's happening. And, you know, maybe you need to get out of there. I couldn't understand. I mean, like everyone, I hadn't.
You know, in those early hours,
it was very foggy. But when I saw, I was, you know, the TV was on when the other, second plane flew into the other tower. That's the moment when I realized it was a passenger jet. That kind of evil hadn't occurred to me. And I think for all of us, you know, that's what violence is about. It escalates and it takes on proportions that we never imagined, and sadly we become somewhat anesthetized to it.
Yeah, well, of course, this piece is a good way to become unanesthetized.
Yes, which I think is really important.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful piece, and it's also, I think, a reminder piece, because we have to really hang on to this event in an important way so that we can try to avoid it, if at all possible.
Because it's such an intense piece, and a lot of these pieces that deal with tragedy, often the composer or the poet or the novelist will choose to end on an uplifting note. John does not choose to do that in this piece. It's a really very intense experience for the audience. What, as a performer, what are you hoping the audience, what would you like to have the experience of the audience be for this particular piece sitting in the hall?
I think it's just to exist in the moment and try to inhabit the space of the event. And there's no real prescription for what people should or should not feel. I think it's an important experience to have in the company of 2,000 other people, because it draws us together as human beings. And I don't think there's a way to put a happy ending on this story. And, John doesn't try to do that. And I don't feel that he ever tries to sugarcoat any of these narratives, whether it's about Nixon or Klinghoff or about 9/11. You know, these are genuine narratives that are trying to speak the truth. But, of course, often the truth is in one's perspective. So I feel here he's really just trying to give us a space to exist and inhabit that incredibly traumatic event.
You're revisiting this piece. You did it many years ago.
Right.
What do you think your approach is going to be this time? Will it be different? Will we be looking at it with different ears and eyes?
I think so. The last time I did it was much closer to 9/11, and I did it in Australia, and so it was a different point of view. You know, it's interesting because I listen to my son and his friends talk about 9/11, like I spoke about Kennedy's assassination. You know, it's a landmark event changes
for their generation.
Right.
This is the equivalent of our Kennedy assassination.
It's interesting because for me, it still feels. I guess I'm still in disbelief. I still say, well, how can that have happened? But for the next generations, this is an important landmark and a defining moment for our country. And I think getting that distance on it and some perspective gives it a universality and a sort of a universal message quality that I'm hoping I can tap into this time.
Maren Alsop is the music director of the Baltimore Symphony. We're going to listen now to a little of John Adams' terrific cantata on the Transmigration of Souls. The piece is about 25 minutes long. We're going to listen to the first half of it. Here's music of John Adams on the Transmigration of Souls on Choral Arts Classics.
missing. 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 Missing.
John Florio. Christina Flannery.
Missing.
John Florio. Christina Flannery.
Missing.
John Florio. Christina Flannery. Lucy Fishman. Richard Johnson Florio. Lucy Fishman. Christina Flannery.
Missing.
John Richard Fitzsimmons.
Missing.
John Richard Fitzsimmons. Christina Flannery.
Missing.
John Florio. David Flannery.
Missing.
Joseph W. Flann. David Flann. John.
Missing.
Joseph W. Flann.
Helen
John.
D. Cook.
Joseph
missing.
W. Flann. John.
Helen D. Cook.
Christina
John.
Flannery.
Missing.
Joseph W. Flann.
Helen D. Cook.
Christina
missing.
Flannery. Carl
Helen D.
Carl Sittinger.
Missing.
Fletcher. Carl Sittinger.
Missing.
Carl Sittinger.
Missing.
Fletcher. Carl Sittinger. Carl Sittinger.
Missing.
Lucy Fishman.
My brother.
Missing.
Carl
Sittinger.
My brother.
Jane S. Beaton.
Daniel the
missing. Jane
my brother.
S. Beaton.
Matthew Timothy O'Mahony.
Missing.
Daniel Call her mother.
music of John Adams, the first part of his cantata on the transmigration of souls. Lauren Mazel conducted the New York Philharmonic with the New York Choral Artists and the Brooklyn Youth Chorus. This recording is from 2002, the year in which the work was premiered. Maren Alsop will conduct On the Transmigration of Souls with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, and the Peabody Children's Chorus in concerts at Strathmore Hall in Bethesda and the Meyerhof in Baltimore, June 5th through 8th. That program will also feature Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. On 88.1, it's Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, and Maren Alsop is my guest this evening. So, Maren, let's talk a little bit about the Ninth Symphony, another piece that is quite extraordinary in the canon, and something somewhat like John Adams' piece on the transmigration of souls. The forces that Beethoven decides to use for his Ninth Symphony are quite unprecedented for the time.
At the time that Beethoven wrote his Ninth Symphony and added chorus, in addition to soloists, solo vocalists, people were aghast and looked at him as though he were completely mad. I mean, I think they already thought he was bordering on the verge of that. So, and it's interesting because when you read commentaries about the premiere and about the symphony, people were so negative about this idea. You know, they felt it was some kind of a sellout to add chorus to a symphony, and yet,
yeah,
of course,
because he very purposely called it a symphony instead of an oratorio,
right,
or
exactly,
a cantata or something.
Exactly, and you know, you didn't mess with the symphonic form in that way, and so I think they felt that it was a bit of a sellout, like going Hollywood or something like that. And it's interesting because, of course, as we know now today, it's if not. The most popular piece in the world, certainly close to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the popularity derives perhaps from some extra musical associations with this piece. I mean, and it seems like Beethoven was quite purposely trying to almost do something bigger than music. It was certainly bigger than the symphonic form.
Mm, I agree.
There's an explicit call for brotherhood and joy, literally.
I think for Beethoven, you know, this is his philosophy about living and about humanity and about spirituality. And, you know, he's really trying to address global issues for himself. And throughout his music, the theme of underlying belief and faith in the goodness of mankind and the ability of people to overcome duress and trauma and tragedy by uniting and getting together. And so this is the ultimate message piece for him. But, I mean, if you go back, Fidelio is all about the triumph of love over evil. It's always good versus evil, this
right.
idea.
And that was his one big opera, Fidelio.
Yeah, Fidelio. Mm-hmm. And so many of his pieces go from the darkness into the light. Even his Fifth Symphony, famous Fifth Symphony, it starts in C minor but ends in C major with, you know, trombones coming in, and it's a joyous kind of end. And it's interesting because his life was so traumatic unto itself, yet he was able to maintain this optimism and sense of possibility, which comes through, you know, just exponentially in this Ninth Symphony.
Yeah, that really is quite extraordinary. A guy who was in so much personal, physical pain. Mm-hmm. He was very sick. This piece he wrote 3 years before his death. This is in 1824. Where was he in his life at that moment? Was he
all
right?
No, not
considered?
At all. Gosh,
right.
I think, you know, by this point, he was profoundly deaf. He was suffering also from other acute illnesses. Over the years, people have tried to tie everything to his deafness. But as it turns out, he seemed to have terrible digestive and stomach ailments. I mean, extraordinarily painful. He had lots and lots of physical problems, and he refused ever to take any kind of drugs of the time. You know, I'm sure he had a few good bloodlettings and whatever that were
right.
was popular in the moment. But, you know, I think the fact also that he, like so many people in pain in those days, would self-medicate to a certain degree by drinking. But of course, alcohol was in lead containers, so that only exacerbated his, you know, condition and worsened it. So by the time he's writing the Ninth Symphony, I mean, he's in agony, but refuses to take any drugs because they could, you know, impair his creative spark.
Sure. When you learn a piece or relearn a piece like On the Transmigration of Souls, a piece that you've done, you know, many years ago, that's a very different process, I would imagine, than when you revisit the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, which is a piece I'm sure you're called on to do, you know, many times in many places with many orchestras. The BSO has actually done it every year for the past several years, and you've done, you know, a few of those performances. How do you approach it each time you do it, the next time?
Well, I think it's important to look at it fresh and try to pretend at least to be coming to it for the first time. I always like to try to imagine what the first performance would have sounded like, you know, and how it would have felt to be in the audience to hear something as avant-garde as this piece and outside of the box. And this time I'm looking toward the earlier instrument practices a bit more, and I got a set of bowings from the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, a period instrument orchestra that I work with often in London. And I'm just looking at those to see how I want to incorporate the, you know, what it would have sounded like in Beethoven's day with our contemporary orchestra. It's interesting because the pendulum is now swinging the other way, and big orchestra, sort of robust, full-blown Beethoven is coming back into fashion. I guess I don't like to be in fashion, so I'm looking back now to the period instruments.
Well, we're very much looking forward to this out-of-fashion performance of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony as we look forward to all of the shows that we do together. So, Maren Alsop, thanks so much for your time
today. Thank you, Tom. It should be a great show. I look forward to working with you.
Me too. Maren Alsop is the music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. We're going to take a listen now to the finale, the choral finale, the so-called Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Music of Beethoven here on Choral Arts Classics.
Thank you.
music of Ludwig van Beethoven, the final movement of his final symphony, the Ode to Joy, from the Symphony No. 9. Kurt Mazur conducted the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and the Leipzig Radio Chorus. The quartet of soloists included Anna Tamova-Sintau, Annelies Burmeister, Peter Schreier, and Theo Adam. Maren Alsop will conduct the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra and the Baltimore Choral Arts Society with soloists Angela Mee, Jennifer Johnson Kano, Dimitri Pittis, and Baltimore native James Morris. Those concerts will take place in the first week of June, and the week before, the Women of the Choral Arts Chorus will join Maren Alsop and the BSO in a series of performances of Mendelssohn's incidental music to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Come to Choral Arts' website, baltimorechoralarts.org, and we'll give you a link to complete information. On 88.1, it's Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, and now we turn to two gifted composers who are also singers in the Choral Arts Chorus, and they are part of a consortium of composers who have started a new chorus here in Baltimore that will focus on performing music by area composers. Joshua Bornfield and Douglas Buchanan join me in the studio. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
So, Doug, the Canticum Novum is the name of the group, and what's the animating force behind it?
The idea is new song that we're supporting local composers, at least to begin with, and we're featuring their music, and we're also pairing that with older musics, early music from the Renaissance and medieval eras. So Canticum Novum means new song, but of course that's in Latin, and that's something that's not spoken very frequently anymore. And we like the idea of juxtaposing these things, letting them sort of communicate across the centuries. It really highlights some really special moments that happen in each genre of pieces.
And Josh Bornfield, both you and Doug will have pieces on the concert that you're going to be doing on the 7th of May. The concert is called Where There Is Love. What's the organizing principle behind this particular show?
The notion behind the new music on this concert really focuses on it focuses on the Ubi Caritas text itself. We found that to be a really wonderful unifying factor. Specifically, I mean, in Baltimore City, we have, you know, we've got all these murals all over the place that just say love. And it's a wonderful sense as you drive through the city to feel bound to one another because of that sense of space.
Yeah, and let's remind folks that Ubi Caritas is a text from the Catholic lectionary, mm-hmm. Ubi Caritas et Amor Deus Ibi Est, where God, or where charity and love are, God is. Yeah, so you're going to have different settings of that Latin text by different composers.
Indeed. Six of them, in fact.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah. Each of the composers that are involved in the piece, Doug, myself, Sean Doyle, Mike Rickleton, John Belcott, we've all set the Ubi Caritas text in one way or another. Some of us the entire text, some of us only the first, kind of the first lectionary of the prayer. And they're all drastically different, which I think is it's a great, again, unifying factor, not only for the concert, but for us as a philosophy, yeah. That no matter how you choose to say this thing, at the heart of what everyone is saying lies the same basic gift, which is the unified nature of our society.
Yeah. And Doug Buchanan, you guys, we all did a concert together about a year ago in which we did the same poem by two or three different composers. This is mm-hmm. kind of along that idea. And it really is fascinating to see how when different people sit down with those words in front of them, the kind of musical interpretation that comes from that.
It's great. I've had so much fun preparing the scores and seeing how these different personalities and musics emerge, because they are sometimes drastically different in the way that they set them. Sometimes they're even amazingly similar. There's some moments some of the composers set in very similar ways. There's even two pieces that set the same text using exactly the same notes. And
But they didn't know.
But they
that.
Didn't know.
They did it separately.
They had no idea. But it's wonderful to see these ideas bouncing off each other and acting in a at once organically unified but personally diverse kind of way. It's really wonderful.
Yeah. So Josh Bornfield, as a composer, you sit down with this text, which isn't very long to begin with. What's your first step as you start, you know, cogitating about what musical ideas might spring from that literary inspiration?
This text was a particularly difficult text to set, I think, because it's been set by so many composers and because it's so ubiquitous in our community. So my first step was reciting the poem until I had the entire thing memorized in English and Latin, and reciting it in Latin to the point where I no longer understood the words as words until they were just a series of sounds, and allowing those phonemes to kind of guide me into a sound world that they would suggest in and of themselves, disregarding even the meaning of the text, and then trying to superimpose the meaning that I brought from the text onto that series of what were, at that point, unrelated sounds.
Interesting. So you wanted to disassociate yourself from what the words actually meant at some point.
Well, actually, what I wanted to do was bring forward the meaning that I gleaned from them rather than the meaning that could be read directly off the page. Mm-hmm. Again, since we're dealing with a text that has a biblical association or a sacred association, I wanted to draw out the human nature of it rather than the divine. And the best way for me to do that was... again, to make the words themselves not seem as though they were communicating anything, to give them more power on their own.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so, Doug Buchanan, you're going to do not just new music by the folks who've set this text, but you're going to juxtapose it with some older music. Very quickly, what else is on the show?
Sure. We're looking at Dunstable's Quam Pulchra Es, How Beautiful You Are, Duraflay's setting of Ubi Caritas et Amor, a wonderful chant by Hildegard von Bingen that's not often performed, Caritas Abundat in Omnia, Love Abounds in Everything. And we're also doing Monteverdi's seminal piece, Cruda Amarilli, Cruel Amaryllis, a different sort of take on love than the other parts of the program.
All right. Well, guys, break a leg. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, a great show, and thanks for coming in tonight and talking about it. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Joshua Bornfield and Douglas Buchanan. Canticum Novum will present this concert. It's called Where There Is Love, and it will feature music by John Bellcott, Joshua Bornfield, Douglas Buchanan, Sean Doyle, Michael Rickleton, and several others. The show is on Wednesday night, May 7th at 7:30 at Old St. Paul's Church, and you can find Canticum Novum on Facebook for complete information. That will wrap it up for this edition and for this season of Choral Arts Classics. We hope you'll join us for our final two series of concerts this season with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. We'll perform the incidental music from Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream, May 29th through June 1st. And from June 5 through 8, we'll join with Maren Alsop and the BSO for John Adams' Pulitzer Prize-winning cantata on the transmigration of souls, as well as Beethoven's immortal Ninth Symphony. Come to baltimorechoralarts.org for a link to more information. Baltimore Choral Arts has announced the programs that we'll be doing next season. It's our 49th season, and we're pleased to be doing the Bach Magnificat and the first performance in our history of Rafe Vaughan Williams' wonderful cantata, Dona Nobis Pacem. We'll perform our annual Christmas concert at the Baltimore Basilica, and we'll also feature music by Mozart, Beethoven, and Ervo Pärt as well. Check out our website for complete information about the programs and how to order tickets. And also, when you visit baltimorechoralarts.org, you can order Choral Arts CDs, including Christmas in America's First Cathedral and a recording with jazz legend Dave Brubeck. Again, for information about any of our concerts, please come to baltimorechoralarts.org or give us a call at 410-523-7070. You can hear Choral Arts Classics on the radio or on demand. Go to WIPR.org and catch up on the shows that you may have missed or shows that you'd like to hear again. The producer of Choral Arts Classics is Aaron Henkin. Don't forget to tune into The Signal Friday night and Saturday afternoon, produced by Aaron Henkin and Lisa Morgan, along with Andy Beanstock. And please join me, Sheila Cast, and Nathan Sterner for Maryland Morning tomorrow morning at 9, right after Morning Edition. I'm Tom Hall for WIPR and the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. Thanks for joining us for another season of Choral Arts Classics.